Hello and welcome to another edition of Authors Audio. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. Remember, you can listen to all of our interviews by going to our website at www.authorsaudio.com. Click on the listen icon at the top of the homepage or the iTunes icon and listen from there. I have a gentleman on the show today that has been at the forefront of alternative fuel technology since the 1970s. So that's going back a few years. I'm talking about someone you may have heard of. His name is David Bloom. He has a book out called Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And that's a very, very easy name to remember. And I'll tell you that David is the kind of guy that leaves no stone unturned. The book is 600 pages and covers absolutely everything you'd want to know on how to make your own ethanol for your vehicle or other gasoline-driven products. He also teaches people how to, in fact, set up a business and sell this to your neighbors, which is kind of interesting because then basically you're paying absolutely nothing for any alcohol that you would use. He has personally taught over 7,000 people how to produce and use low-cost alcohol fuel in his intensive workshops. He wrote and hosted the 10-part PBS series, Alcohol as Fuel. David has also been a pioneer in community-supported agriculture, and he is the executive director of the Institute for Ecological Agriculture, where he teaches permaculture. He consults for governments, farmers, companies, and many others interested in turning waste into fuel and profitable products. And it is with great pleasure that I welcome to Authors Audio today David Bloom, the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. David, welcome to the program, and how are you?
Well, hi, Jake. Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on the program there, David. I appreciate you coming. Maybe we could start off with you telling our listeners a little bit about how you got interested in this subject and, of course, blossomed out into this magnificent career for you where you're traveling all around the world teaching people how to do what you have learned quite a while ago, I guess.
Well, I started in the late 70s, actually coming out of college as an ecologist, and learned about alcohol back then and was flabbergasted that the history of alcohol as a fuel wasn't known to everybody because, as far as I knew, gasoline was the only fuel ever on the market. But it turned out that alcohol was the first fuel before gasoline was ever invented, and it's always been the best fuel. Alcohol, in fact, even was used to power our streetlights as gas lamps or alcohol lamps all the way into the 1900s, and of course lit homes all over the country all through the 1800s. So when the internal combustion engine came on the scene, there was a fuel available for it, and that was alcohol. Gasoline came later as a byproduct of Rockefeller's foul kerosene business. Everything that was volatile or explosive, nobody wanted for oil lamps because it would turn them into Molotov cocktails. So he flushed that stuff into rivers at night to get rid of it. And nowadays, we call that stuff gasoline, which is all the volatile byproducts of oil.
And gasoline is, if I'm correct on this, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but gasoline itself is really the lowest form of fuel. After everything else has been taken out of a barrel of oil, gasoline is way down on the list as far as the quality. Is that right?
Whatever's left over from making valuable materials out of oil, whether it's linoleum or nylons or pesticides or whatever, whatever's left over, the toxic stuff that sits in the vat after you get off whatever product you're making, gets thrown together and sold to us as gasoline. So we pay for the privilege of disposing of the oil company's toxic waste.
Well, it was very fortuitous and very insightful, really, for you to see up the road years ago and start getting into this whole business that you're in right now. You're teaching, but you've also gone through the process yourself. And now I believe the United States was at its peak oil production around 1973. I think various different people will quote different things, but I think the world is somewhere around the peak oil production right now, maybe even a little past it. And the other bottom line is that we just have to get off of this dirty stuff. It's just polluting our air. And how many cars and trucks are running every single day on the planet? When you think about that, it's really mind-blowing. And I'm glad that you came along when you did and started to educate people on how they can change and actually make money from the change. It's a double winner, this idea, my fellow listeners. So we'll continue on with David's story.
Well, that's right. All around the world, people have figured out that oil is running out. There's really no doubt about that. Oil production plateaued a few years ago, but demand keeps going up. And so we're looking at a world that's going to be increasingly short of fuel. And what we do next, now that petroleum is running out, means everything to whether we survive as a species on this planet or not. The oil companies are not going to just say, well, gosh, it's been a good 100 years making petroleum, but we're just going to close up now since we're running out. No, they've got plans for us, and those plans are pretty dark indeed. And alcohol is one of our only ways out of the trap the oil companies have set for us. Some of their solutions are to make synthetic oil from oil shale in the Rockies, or tar sand out of Canada, or worse yet, gasoline into coal. And all of these are climate-destroying processes where up to 1,000 times or more greenhouse gases are produced than are from petroleum. So if we go down that dark route where we make synthetic oil just so we can keep using gasoline, it'll be the end of life itself. So luckily we have alternatives, and alcohol is about the best of most of the good clean alternatives for running our vehicles and generators and cooking and everything else. So alcohol, of course, is moonshine. It's hardly toxic at all, although there's been a few mornings I've woken up after a party where I could swear it was a bit toxic, but it's really, you know, essentially edible. And when you burn it, it's 98% pollution-free compared to gasoline. So none of the smog-making components of gasoline exist in the exhaust of alcohol. It's so clean, in fact, that the inside of your engine stays bright and shiny instead of being covered with black, sooty carbon. And that carbon is what wears your engine out. It's what turns your oil black. And it acts like microscopic sandpaper, wearing out the rings and cylinders in your car. And with alcohol, none of that ever forms because it's so clean burning. It actually triples the life of your engine. Well, when it comes to greenhouse gases, too, it puts out carbon dioxide into the air and water vapor because it's a hydrocarbon. You know, so the hydrogen mixes with oxygen and becomes water vapor. The carbon mixes with oxygen becomes carbon dioxide. So both of those things are greenhouse gases because that new water vapor is also an insulator as well as the carbon dioxide, causing the temperature of the planet to go up. But with alcohol, plants use up water and carbon dioxide while they're growing and make carbohydrates, which we then ferment into alcohol. So a carbohydrate is carbon dioxide for the carbo, and hydrate is water. So we make starches and sugars, which we then ferment using yeast into essentially wine, and then we distill that into essentially whiskey, which we then use to power our cars. So when we burn the alcohol, we're burning liquid solar energy. As we burn the alcohol, sunlight drives the car down the road. That's the explosion. And out of the tailpipe, well, goes the carbon dioxide and water, the same thing the plant breathes in to make the alcohol. So it's a circle. Plants absorb carbon dioxide, and then it's released from the tailpipe to be reused by next year's crop. When we don't add extra carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, the Earth can sop up the excesses of the past from oil, and we can very quickly draw down global warming.
Everything you say there, David, makes absolutely perfect sense to me, and I'm sure it's making perfect sense to almost everybody else out there that's listening. And I guess there's the odd guy out there thinking, well, you want me to pour my whiskey into my gas tank? And we're saying, not really, no. You're going to be using ethanol, which comes from plants and turned into an ethanol-based alcohol, which you'll be burning in your car. But having said that, let's go on, David, with a little bit of what you describe in the book on how this process takes place and what are some of the best plants we can grow in, for example, Ontario or anywhere in northern to mid regions of the United States, places like that. Let's see if we can walk through that a little bit for our listeners now.
Well, you know, it really is based on your soil type and your weather and everything else. And so there is no one magic bullet crop. Corn is a mediocre crop for alcohol production. It only produces about 250 gallons per acre or so. But far north, we can grow other crops such as fodder beets, which are used extensively in Europe and could be used in the northern areas of North America, where they tolerate the winter just fine. And fodder beets are like 15-pound sugar beets, which we can ferment into alcohol at the rate of over 1,000 gallons an acre and twice as much animal feed per acre as corn. Because you got to realize, corn is not really being fed to people. It's really animal feed. More than 90% of our corn goes to feed animals. So when you're looking at something to replace corn, you want to replace the animal feed as well. And beet pulp has every bit as much value as corn, and we get twice as much per acre because beets are more productive. You mentioned sorghum, which is a corn-like crop, although it's a little bit more like sugarcane. Corn and sorghum and sugarcane are all grasses, and both sorghum and sugarcane make thick, sugary canes that we can squeeze the sugar out of and then make alcohol. The Amish have made blackstrap molasses for years out of the canes of sorghum, pretty far north in the United States. That's another potentially 1,000-gallon per acre crop.
Yeah, that's really exciting, David. I think I heard you say somewhere, I could be wrong, where there was one crop that would yield possibly $10,000 an acre. I'm not sure what crop that was, but maybe you could help me with that.
Well, I think what you're talking about is something a little bit like sorghum and grows all the way to the Arctic Circle, which is cattails. Cattails grow in marshes, and you've all seen them. They look like a stick with a hot dog on top when they're flowering, but otherwise they look like big, tall grass. And they make huge amounts of starch in the base of the stalk and in the roots. Cattails actually are the most productive land plant we have available to us. In the United States, over 500 places use cattails to absorb the nutrients out of sewage. After the sewage has had its primary treatment, they run it through a cattail marsh, which absorbs all those excess nutrients before the water is discharged into rivers. So this is a way of cleaning up very thoroughly sewage that's been treated. When we do it that way, you've got a plant that's got unlimited water, unlimited nutrients, and now we're looking at 7,000 or 8,000 gallons per acre and huge amounts of animal feed from cattails, which we can harvest anywhere from the tropics all the way to the Arctic Circle. So if all the human sewage in the United States was treated via cattails, we could replace all, and I mean all, of the gasoline and diesel in the United States with less than 2% of our farmland. So yes, we can do this. We have enough land. We have smart people and good crops and good farmers willing to do the work. I'm working with the American Corn Growers Association, for instance. Part of their mission is to diversify the cropping their farmers do. They're not wedded to corn at all. In fact, they're pretty disgusted with how oil companies and others have manipulated the price of corn over the last few years and really jerked them around in their livelihood. So if they can get off of corn and onto a variety of other crops, there's no way to control those farmers, and they're going to regain their independence.
With all the information that you're giving out freely over the air here in the interview, I want to thank you for that. And also, the book is just that much more informative and detailed. I can see those ears up against the speaker thinking, I don't want to miss a word of this. But are there any laws prohibiting the growth or selling or making of ethanol in the United States at the present time?
Oh, no, not at all. We won those battles in the 1980s where we established a small-scale distiller's license, which is still in existence today. It allows you to make 5,000 gallons per year on a free permit from the federal government. And in the book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, we include a copy of the permit as well as all the instructions on filling it out. But so many people have bought the book that the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Department has thrown up their hands and say, don't send us any more permits. We can't process them. Just tell us when your still is done already. So, you know, getting a permit first is not even important anymore. And it's kind of amusing to call the ATF and ask them about it because they get so exasperated by all the readers of the book now making fuel.
What about running diesel engines on ethanol-based products? Is that possible right now, David?
Yes, that's our book's the only place you can get that information. We show six different ways that different countries have converted diesels to alcohol. Anywhere from 20% diesel to 100%, 20% alcohol to 100% alcohol, depending on the method used. And diesels, of course, are way more polluting than gasoline engines. So when we use alcohol in a diesel engine, we are really displacing a lot of pollution when we get rid of diesel.
Well, wouldn't it be nice, David, to have those all those rigs on the road and the buses that use diesel and all the other different engines that use diesel to be able to run on an ethanol-based product? What a difference, because diesel is such a dirty fuel. It's the soot coming out of those stacks is something else. And if you're in any major city, of course, you can smell the diesel. It's all over the place. And it's not just CO2 coming out of those exhaust pipes either. I was able to be in Sao Paulo, Brazil for a little while one time, and I think Brazil is either totally on ethanol or very close to being totally on ethanol. And this is a country that is, you know, considered a third world country, but they are moving fast into the new world of energy generation for their vehicles and other things. And we got to get on this road. I mean, it's just as simple as that. What a difference it would make in terms of world politics. And we haven't really even talked about that.
Yes, 85% of the cars in Brazil run on straight ethanol now. And all the cars in Brazil that are not ethanol, the ones that supposedly run on gas, that's only 75% gas and 25% alcohol. So there is no straight gasoline in Brazil whatsoever. You can run up to 50% alcohol in your unmodified car without making any changes to your car whatsoever. Your car's computer is flexible enough to use up to 50% alcohol, and some can even use more. With the instructions in Alcohol Can Be a Gas, you can use off-the-shelf parts to convert your car to run on straight alcohol if you'd like. Alcohol is sold at the pump in the United States, and I believe increasingly so in Canada, as E85, which is 85% alcohol, 15% gas. But you don't need the gasoline at all when you are running a car in alcohol. It's just a regulatory thing that was imposed some years ago. In Brazil, they no longer import any oil for transportation fuel whatsoever. They've completely eliminated the need of foreign oil to make their fleets run. And in fact, they dump extra waste gasoline on the world market because they have so much surplus from the little bit of oil refining they do accomplish there. So here's a large country that's already gotten off of petroleum to run its vehicles, and there's no reason why we can't do the same.
Right.
The car companies down there that make the engines for alcohol are, you know, they're not very well known. They're companies like GM and Ford and Chrysler, you know. So in other words, they up here complain that they can't make cars run on alcohol for 2 or 3 years when they tell Obama they want, you know, stimulus money. But in Brazil, they're already making them, and it doesn't cost them more than about $30 a piece on the assembly line to make them run on both alcohol and gas. They are flexible fuel, you know, compared to a gasoline-only car. So in Brazil, if you have a gasoline-only car, you can't sell it at all, and that'll be the way it is here someday.
Well, David, don't start me talking about the big three car companies, because, you know, we've both in Canada and the U.S. here, we've been subsidizing them for a very long time, not just the recent subsidies of billions of dollars as they cry the blues so they can make it through another month. The fact of the matter is, obviously, they're not making cars people want to buy. That's a big part of it. And maybe, just maybe, if Obama was in gear with them, he should be sitting down with the chairman of the boards and all the rest of that and saying, look, like, if you can produce cars running on ethanol, 100% ethanol, by the way, or ethanol and electric or something of that nature, then maybe we can look at giving you a little bit of extra cash to get going. But if they can't figure that out within a month or two, I think Obama should just say, well, you know, you gave it your best try. You know, you're not producing anything people want. So now it's time to say bye-bye. And there'll be somebody else right there with the cars that people want to buy and the cars that they can afford to buy it and run. And it just drives me nuts that anybody should be giving them a dime if they can't figure that out, as you and I can figure it out right here. Well, just moving on briefly to another very problematic issue, which is around us every day, is the health problems caused by burning fossil fuels. And it is immense. These things, like I said before, and you have also talked about, is these things are just burning every day, all day, the coal plants, the cars, the trucks, and on it goes, the diesel trains, and people are breathing in this stuff, and in the larger cities they're breathing in a heck of a lot more, and we're seeing tremendous costs in lung disease and heart disease related to this problem of these emissions. And maybe we could just talk about that a little bit, because I think it's a very important another side that society could actually be saving people and saving money at the same time by moving over to what you're advocating.
Well, you think about the 14,000 people a year who die in Los Angeles from respiratory disease, and that's mostly caused by benzene, toluene, and xylene, which are all fierce carcinogens that are 25% to 41% of gasoline in California. And so, you know, what's that worth? 15,000 people a year. You know, nobody calculates that in there. And actually, when you look at all the subsidies that oil gets, the ones that are hidden in the U.S. income tax, the oil companies are getting subsidized at over $5 a gallon compared to any other industry. And so they whine and moan and complain about the piddly little 50 cents that alcohol gets as a subsidy, but it doesn't come near putting us on the level playing field with big oil. I mean, get this, they get an oil depletion allowance, meaning they get to write off their taxes a huge credit because they are depleting oil. It's like, who thought that up? That's a completely insane tax credit. And for all the money that they invest overseas, they don't pay taxes on that. And it goes on. All the, you know, and if you could count Iraq, although it wasn't counted in the $5, you could count Iraq as a giant subsidy for big oil, you know, to try to secure those oil fields. You know, it all depends on how you want to do the accounting. But even without counting Iraq, you know, we are just being soaked to the tune of $5 a gallon out of our income taxes. For instance, after 9/11, the U.S. government gave a grant, in other words, free money to the oil companies to improve security around the refineries to the tune of $80 million. And the entire U.S. solar research budget was smaller than that. So, you know, that's the kind of scale of things, the giveaways to the oil companies that are just nuts.
You know, David, I couldn't agree with you more. I hear this constant nonsense from time to time on television about, oh, these people are taking entitlements. I mean, they're taking money out of the government and not giving anything back. They're taking entitlements like welfare and you know, Medicare and whatever it is. I mean, it's their country too, for starters. And what about the billions of dollars given out by the federal government in corporate welfare every year, including agriculture, including the car industries, including the banks now, and many others? And we don't hear the congressman saying, oh, that's terrible. These companies should never have these entitlements. Well, you know, what they really should be saying is, why don't you put the money into the fuel that'll get us off oil, period. Get us off oil through ethanol fuels, combination of electric and ethanol, and so on and so forth, and get into the real 21st century. You know, I have no idea why people are dodging the inevitable, and that is that oil is slowly just going to be finally over. We're going to have used it all, and where are we going to be? So other countries are getting far ahead of us. We better get on out there and start developing very innovative ways of doing things, or we're going to be left behind.
Well, but also, you know, since that's the way it is, well, let's go ahead and make sure we stick our hand in the till, too. So the tax credits that are available for alcohol, and these mostly go to oil companies when they buy alcohol to blend with gasoline, it's about 61 cents a gallon. So we can get the same tax credits, because when we make alcohol, we fill out the one page of paperwork at the end of the month, send it in to our Internal Revenue Service, and 90 days later, they send us a check for 61 cents a gallon for every bit of alcohol we made. So we can thank the oil companies for creating the situation where we get to collect the credit as well. So here you are making alcohol from, let's say, donuts. I use donuts because, you know, cops can only eat so many and then they throw the rest away. So a pickup truck full of donuts will make you 100 gallons of alcohol. So here I go ahead and make the alcohol for about 30 cents a gallon in a still that I build myself from the instructions in Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And then the government sends me 61 cents a gallon for doing it. So I come out about 30 cents ahead. So it's better than free. I actually come out ahead. Now, it's not always that juicy, but it's usually pretty cheap, no matter how you make the alcohol. But it gets better because the byproducts from making alcohol, let's say from corn, can be turned into all kinds of really valuable things. We only take the starch out when we make alcohol. So all the protein and fat and minerals and all the real nutrition is still there in the byproduct, which we call dried distiller's grains. Now, if we take those grains and we take a little more than a pound or about 7 or 8 cents worth and we feed it to tilapia, which is a great greenhouse grown fish, we get a pound of fish. So we turn 7 cents worth of this great byproduct from alcohol fuel into $7 worth of fish that we can sell in our local markets.
Yeah.
Or we can grow oyster mushrooms where we can take a pound of 5 or 6 cents worth of dried distiller's grains and make $6 or $7 worth of oyster mushrooms to sell, like 100 times markup from our original raw material cost. So in my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, I talk about how we get everything out of whatever the feedstock is. Nothing goes to waste. We'll either make shrimp or fish or earthworm castings or high-value vegetables. For instance, we feed the grain to the fish and then the fish poop in the water. And then we take the fish water and use that to go ahead and water vegetables in our greenhouse. But since we're fermenting the corn, that means we have lots of excess carbon dioxide from the tanks we can put into the greenhouse and get, you know, 3 times the yield in the greenhouse that we normally would. I quote a study from Ontario, actually, up in Canada, where the yields were tripled by using carbon dioxide in the greenhouse. And, of course, we have all this excess warm water from an alcohol plant to keep greenhouses warm. We've already paid for the energy once to make the alcohol. Then we can take the byproduct wastewater and warm the greenhouse. So this kind of integrated farming approach actually generates huge amounts of food at alcohol plants. So far from it being a food versus fuel issue, alcohol plants can be fountains of food, especially far away from where it's available, like fish in the winter, you know, fresh fish in the winter in the middle of Ontario. Or we can be talking about growing fresh vegetables in the middle of winter because we have the ability to enrich the greenhouses with all the byproducts from the alcohol plant and have good local organic produce. So this whole thing about alcohol fuel is really a revolution in how we do things, that we don't just make products and throw away the waste, that every so-called waste product from the alcohol plant is really another way to make edible, important products for people that we can make profit on. And so these small plants that we're talking about that anybody could run are way more profitable than the giant alcohol plants that don't know how to handle all this waste product and make it into valuable products.
Well, I couldn't have said it any better myself, David. You are the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and it sure can be a gas in many ways. It can be a real gas in terms of saving money. It can be a gas in terms of actually making money. And it can be a gas that costs you nothing to drive your car down the road or take trips all over the country. So it's time to get with the 21st century and borrow something from our forefathers and turn it into a something that we can grow, we control. We don't have to start a war in the Middle East or somewhere else to fight over oil. We can be completely released from that. Do you understand how much money that would save? And you know what? The oil companies are just going to have to figure it out as they go along, because if you buy a car with your pocketbook and you say, this is the kind of car I want, or I'm not going to buy a car, you just see how fast the car makers change their ways. And the technology is already being used. Like we said, in Brazil, they're all driving ethanol-based cars. So this is, it's not something from the moon or a pipe dream. It's happening right now. Let's get with the program. Well, once again, I want to thank David Bloom for coming on Authors Audio today to talk about this amazing book and information called Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And if you Google that, you'll find his site. His site is www.permaculture.com. That's permaculture.com. And you can get there and have a look at some of the things that he's got up there. And you can also purchase the book through our website. It will be, just click on the book cover on the home page when it's up there, and it'll take you right into Amazon where you can purchase the book. And until next time, this is Jake D. Steele from Authors Audio saying, keep dreaming and happy reading. Bye for now.